Titans of Text.
Welcome to All Fido's Beastly or Otherwise to Titans of Text podcast. We're your hosts, Eric Ostrich.
And Danny Austerity Nissenfeld.
And we have with us today a man whose name you've probably seen so many times you've forgotten it's there. Michael Seifert, one of the original fathers of the Deku codebase. We're going to talk about the old days of mudding, how Deku came to be, and some new developments around it. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, gentlemen.
So Deku's release truly marks the start of an era. Well, it wasn't, you know, the first mud, which we can credit to Richard Bartle and Troop Shaw. This is where mud began for so many people. But how did Deku start? How did it get its impetus? Why was it made?
Yeah, so Deku started, I think, actually a few months before I joined, where Hans Henrik and Tom and Sebastian and Katja had gotten together and wanted to build Deku Mod. And a few months after that, I was chatting to Hans Henrik. He told me about it. I got all excited. I made a text adventure as, I think, my first coding project when I was a kid. I wanted to join, and Henrik printed out the source code for me. I went on summer vacation, and that was back when you didn't have laptops. So I read the source code, and I was all ready to start coding when I came back to the computer science studies. And that was kind of the start of it, for me at least.
That's amazing that the like early Git was just printing out. That's good.
Definitely. I was used to reading manuals on my summer vacations. That was a thing I did. So,
why did you join the project? Was it just, you know, this idea of an online game of a world like that was just that intriguing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I had been playing LPMod a little bit, and I was really fascinated by it. But at the same time, I also thought it wasn't really. It had the potential to be really fun, but it ended up being just like a game for coders to coders. And I wanted something that had more of a game element to it rather than just being a place to write some code. And that's really why I felt intrigued to join Deku Mod and have the ability to help shape a really cool gaming experience.
So what prompted early on in Deku's adventure or life? There was a push for more capacity. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so in terms of capacity, we were kind of struggling with capacity on several levels. The servers we were running Deku on were quite small, and so we were struggling with memory issues and disk issues and network issues as well. This was back in the day when the internet was quite young. You could only access it if you were on campus or in the military. You couldn't dial up from home. The internet was slow. When we had players from the US playing on our servers here in Europe, they would have considerable lag. So it was quite painful. But obviously, as time went on, things improved and speeds got a little better, servers got a little better. But that was only a few years after that. Initially, we hosted Deku Mod running on Deku servers. But we used to get our process zapped in the wee hours of the morning. And so eventually we moved to a host in Sweden. I think it's called Marcel. And if you look in the source code, you'll see all kind of comments for weird stuff we had to do to make it run on Marcel. And we had a tiny bit of memory to work with. So it was a painful time trying to make a large mod run well.
How did the general public outside of the university, when it started becoming available, really receive it? Did you see a lot of people not at the university actually wanting to log in and play?
Yeah, that's such a fun question. So initially, it was pretty much only students at various universities around the world that would be playing. And I'd sometimes bring some of my friends to campus, and they'd borrow some equipment and sit and play. And it wasn't until a few years later that it became more broadly available. And actually, that kind of leads me into a story about Tuball, because in, I think it was 1993, I wanted to set up Deku so it would be available to people in Denmark that didn't have access to a university campus. And the way to do that back then was using modems, dial-up modems. And so I contacted Tuborg to make a sponsorship agreement with them. So they paid for my modems. I put it up in my closet in my apartment. And I stacked, I think, 32 modems in my closet and didn't really have any ventilation for the server, but it kept running. And Tuborg financed it. And then I introduced the Tuborg beer into the game, as that was kind of Tuborg's reward for sponsoring it. And that's how the Tuborg came to be part of the game.
So you mentioned people in the States playing, and I was one of them trying to play on European MUDs, on original Deku, in fact. How much of a... Now, mind you, at this point, I was like... how old was I? I was in my early teens, my tweens, like the 10 to 12.
Yeah.
How was the kind of culture? Was there a culture clash? Could you tell people were Americans? Like, how was it with people trying to connect from the States?
No, it was exciting, right? The idea that you were chatting live with people from all around the world, no matter where they were from, was really an exciting concept. And whenever you told people about it back then, it sounded almost like a science fiction movie, right? So it was part of what made this whole experience so unique at the time.
So what was the motivation behind initially releasing the source code to the Deku license open source?
Yeah, I actually don't recall that we talked that much about it initially. I think at some point when the first version of Deku kind of, we thought, hey, this is something that's working. At that point in time, I think Sebastian just said, hey, I'll upload it on a server for other people to access. And I think that's kind of how it just started. I can't even remember when we made the first license agreement. Was kind of perchance the natural thing to do, I think.
This kind of relates to something we asked Richard Bartle back when we interviewed him last year. And he, of course, he answered with that he was happy that they intended, even though they made money on it initially, they intended for this to explode and get many, many people making their own stuff. How was the opinion of what was going on within your team, within the Deku team, when everyone began essentially forking the code with Merc and then Circle and Rom and all of the children of Deku, as we usually call them?
Well, there's many facets to that reply. I think on the one hand, it's of course incredibly flattering that people take the work you made and start enhancing it and building their own world on top of it. So that was the rewarding bit. It also started keeping us, or at least me and Hans Henrik at the time, a bit on the edge of our seats, because we had to continue to do really great stuff in Decomod to have it an interesting place to play. So I think it was good overall for the development of the game. It felt a little bit like competition, but I think it may also have made me at least a little more protective about my source code for Deku 2. And I did consider commercializing it at a point in time. We can talk about that maybe later. It was kind of, as I said, many facets and both exhilarating, but also giving you this feeling of having to protect it a little bit.
We're going to turn the clock a little bit forward on the same question. Deku Combat, and it's the combat engine within Deku, the auto combat, the rounds, the outside of auto combat skills like kick and bash and whatever. Yeah. That's pretty much modern graphical MMORPG combat as well. Yeah. WoW, EQ, all of them use that model. How... Do you ever think about that? Was that when EQ first came out, when EverQuest first came out?
Yeah.
Was that something like, hey, this is like our stuff, like we made this?
No, I not really. There's two stories to it. When I look generally, no, it didn't cross my mind. There was a special story around EverQuest because some team member from the EverQuest team had said that they had used the Decomod source code, which of course we kept hearing it. We couldn't just let that slide by. But it turned out that the employee was confused about the meaning of having used the source code and having been inspired by the game concepts. So there wasn't a problem after all with it. But No, I mean, the way we designed the combat engine was largely inspired, I think, initially by just your classical Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, and then later on also by the Rollmaster standard system. And those role-playing games are turn-based, and so it just seemed like the natural thing to do.
Okay, so this one might be a bit hard to answer, maybe depending on how, because of how long ago it was. But what was the labor split on building out what, at this point, of what we'd call the stock areas versus like coding new features?
Yeah, that's a very hard question to answer. I think it was very much an integral effort. So when I think about, for example, the capital of Midgard, which I think is probably one of the most famous parts of Decumon, is I spent a lot of time building that out, but it was intermixed with coding and having to build new things in code to support what I wanted to create in terms of an experience from a game perspective. Yeah, I could probably add that, of course, I think for us as code creators, it was very much an integrated effort, but there were so many zones and world areas created by other people. That, of course, we didn't build, but they built. That's Heorndor, the sewers of Midgard, and an incredible number of zones. All high-quality content that I think in many ways the game would never have become what it did if there weren't so many passionate people out there just building exciting areas to play in.
So probably the most iconic figures, not living figures, but fictional figures in all of Mudding, at least anyone that's played a Deku, would be the beastly Fido and the mayor of Midgard. Who can forget the mayor running around, opening the gates and declaring things, and of course the Fido eating your corpses before you get a chance to loot them or do anything else. So where did that come from?
That's just such a delightful question. I didn't even know that Beastly Fido was a thing until you asked me the question now. As far as I recall, sometime after the alpha release, I made most of Midgard together with a lot of people so we could have a really good starting capital. And I had a lot of help, of course. And one of the problems we ran into was that players were just attacking local shopkeepers and local guards. So we had to find a way to get rid of all the corpses that were scattered across town. And that's really where Fido came in. And so Fido is inspired by my mom's foul-smelling old beagle that was called Sven. And the old beagle would eat literally anything. Once he ate 2 6-pound chickens and survived. So the Beastly Fido is made in his image, and actually you'll also find Sven in the pet shop in Midgard if you want to buy a small beagle as your companion, and his name is even marked in his ear if you look closely. Now, one of the people that helped me make Midgard was Mads Hår, and he's still my friend, and Mads created the backwards walking Odif Iltsep. I don't know if you saw it, but he had a lot of fun with that, and he was never sure if he was going to write that it was made by an insane god or an insane dog, because god and dog spelled backwards becomes the same word, and obviously Odif Iltsep was the reverse spelling of Beastly Fido.
That's kind of an amazing story. I didn't realize the Beastly Fido had so much history. And I'd like to confirm for the record that the movie Frozen, the moose is also named Sven, which means that the Frozen moose is clearly named after the dog in Deku.
No, you're kidding.
I'm just going to have to say that. That must be true. I will not accept any other reality.
What did you say the moose was called in Frozen?
The moose is called Sven. The moose's name is Sven in the Frozen series.
You think so?
So clearly it must be named after this. I can't imagine anything other.
Oh, really? That might be. You never know. But it is a common name though in Scandinavia. So yeah, who knows?
You know, let's. We're not going to talk about the game with this question, but what essentially brought us together today was the relicensing of the Deku code base. We'll passingly mention Opie, the deliverer of relicensing, but he has yet to tell this story to any of us.
Yeah.
What did you think when he first approached you? I mean, how did this all happen?
Yeah, so Opie approached me a few years ago, maybe 3 years ago. I can't remember exactly when. And at that time, I was running Sitecore. And while Opie's suggestion had crossed my mind before, and I really liked it, I just did not have the bandwidth or time to do anything about it. But then he kept gently reminding me, I think every half year or so, and I told him to keep reminding me. And he got decomod.com up and running again. That was a tremendous help. It had vanished somehow on a server that it was on. The server just disappeared. I don't know what happened to it. But OP got it back up. And when I suddenly found myself with a little bit of time on my hands again, I just thought, hey, now's the time. I contacted Sebastian and Henrik Katcher. And we haven't been able to get a hold of Tom. He's like disappeared from the surface of the earth. I don't know what happened to him. But they all loved the idea, and we all wanted to release it on LGPL. So that was an easy decision. And then with the help of Opie, got it all set up, got it pushed out, and really excited to have both the Alpha Gamma versions out, but also to have Decomod 2 from 1997 released on the LGPL. And all of it's available from my GitHub account.
Speaking of Deku 2, what kept that under wraps for so long? I probably missed a good decade or so of the modding community. Myself, between the 2000s and the 2000 late 10s, I guess.
Yeah.
But what I had never even heard of Deku 2 before that.
Yeah.
What kept it in the box, essentially?
Yeah, I think what kept it from being released at the time was that I had an ambition to try to commercialize it at a point in time. And I moved to San Francisco in 1996 and worked with that idea for about 6 months. And I did find a model where it kind of worked, but I could just see it wouldn't really get to the level that I wanted it to be. And I could also see the graphical games just around the corner. I actually contacted a lot of the game companies back then and asked them if we should try to create a graphical one, but all I got back was nasty cease and desist letters, not to send them any ideas. And so eventually, I think what goes with that story is also that then I started working with the Perry brothers. They were in Utah at the time, Ken and Tim Perry. And they essentially took over the game. And the maintenance of the game and whatever little donations came in to keep the game running. And they did that, and they're still doing that today. But I'm working with them now to release Deku 3, which is in the works right now.
Wow, a Deku 3. So yeah. What's the difference between the Dekus then? What major improvements have happened?
So the main change from Decomod 1 to Decomod 2 is that we added in a mod coding language so that you could build interesting quests and interesting NPC behavior, all that kind of stuff. I added shorted path algorithms so NPCs could find their own way around the game, city guards could be patrolling, all that kind of stuff. And in Decomod 3, pretty much all the game logic got moved by the Perry brothers from C into this Decomod coding language that we called DIL. That's, of course, super cool, because if you want to build a different kind of world, a sci-fi environment, whatever you want it to do, you can just change the DIL code. You don't even have to touch the C code to change how the game behaves. And then what we're doing right now before releasing it, and I'll get back to that later maybe in the talk here, is that I would really like to see that there's a much easier way to connect to mods for people in this time and day. It's 2020, and you still have to use Telnet or some arcane client. And so I'm working on adding WebSockets and HTML5. So it's essentially an HTML server, and you just connect with your regular web browser.
Eric and I, more so Eric, has a bit of experience with that. We even have a WebSocket to Telnet routing thing. Oh, cool. I don't know, Eric could definitely talk more about that.
Yeah, I'm sitting here sort of shook just from hearing this, but I've attempted to help upgrade the mudding community as well, and that was actually our next question.
Yeah.
Where like I've done a lot of stuff with Grapevine, which is a Telnet to WebSocket proxy bridge thing. That's amazing to hear that that Deku is gonna get that upgrade to the 20th century or the 21st century.
Yeah. I think that's both kind of the difficulty of connecting for new potential players. I think that's a barrier that you have to take serious. I don't know anybody that could use Telnet today, and installing an odd Windows client, even though they're probably super cool, is also something that would have many people either worried or simply unable to do. I agree that that's important. But what's also on my mind is that once I started doing it, why not just have HTML coming out from the mod server? And essentially, that's how it's working right now. So you can potentially intermix images with the text. You could intermix sounds with the text. And I just think it opens up for a bunch of opportunity if there is a life for this kind of product in the next decade.
I have to, this isn't a question. This is more of me and my efforts to be down with Telnet. No more Telnet, please. And that's what my mud server does. It spits HTML out at the web client, essentially. So this makes me very happy. And now I'm going to have to look into Deku 3 once you guys solidify that.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
I think it'll be out in about a month or so. Depends on how many hours I get to spend here.
Yeah, I mean, release it when it's done. Mm-hmm. The mud community's not going anywhere. Yeah. Definitely let us know when it hits so we can help get the word out. So I'm going to ask, we're coming to the end of the questions we could think of here. And I'm going to ask the same two questions we ended the Richard Bartle interview with, which I feel is very appropriate based on who you are and why we're talking to you. What do you feel is needed to bring new blood into the mudding community specifically, even if it is some ways to attract the young away from the graphical MMOs?
Mm. Yeah, I think that in today's world, mud clearly is a niche offering, and I think it will remain so. It's obviously attractive to players that use text readers because they have to. But what I think would be fantastic would be if you could make enough improvements to at least make it a little more appealing to people that are more visually oriented, adding images, adding sounds, whatever extra. And then possibly have a community where it could be for educational purposes or other purposes. You could have these worlds meet together online. It's obvious it's not going to be as popular as a World of Warcraft ever again. But I think there's potential for having both kinds of players play together.
And the last question is sort of along the same vein. How much should someone that's running a mud, be it a role play intensive mud or a hack and slash along the lines of what a Deku would be, how much do they worry about attracting non-mudders specifically, or more, do you think they should focus on retaining and attracting people already in the community, already inured with MUDs?
I really think that has to be a balance. If you're not there for your base running the MUD, my experience is that the base will kind of slowly dwindle away, because a MUD is not just a game. It's kind of also a social phenomena. But I also think the need to have new players is obvious, and you need to attract them. And I'm hoping that if the community at large could start adopting WebSockets and HTML5, maybe that's the solution to bring a little fresh blood into the MUD scene.
And with that, we're going to bid adieu and say our goodbyes. Thank you so much for coming on to the Titans of Text show. It's really been a pleasure learning about, you know, things that, I don't know, a lot of us take for granted because we've been seeing the same things for 30 years. But it's still amazing. And the whole Deku 3 thing is kind of blowing my mind now. And I look forward very much to its release.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It was a pleasure to be on the show here. I'll give you a heads up when Deku 3 is ready for release.